You may find this hard to believe, but 60 songs that explain the 90s, America's favorite poorly named music podcast, is back with 30 more songs and 120 songs total. I am your host, Rob Harvilla, here to bring you more shrewd musical analysis, poignant nostalgic reveries, crude personal anecdotes, and rad special guests, all with even less restraint than usual. Join us once more on 60 Songs That Explain the 90s every Wednesday on Spotify.
This episode is brought to you by Mint Mobile. If you've had it with your overpriced wireless plan with its insanely high monthly bill and unexpected overages, then listen to this. For a limited time, wireless plans from Mint Mobile are $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan. That's unlimited talk, text, and data for $15 a month. Wow, right? To get this new customer offer, just go to mintmobile.com/watch. That's mintmobile.com/watch. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first three-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for more details.
This episode is brought to you by Empower. You got money questions like, can I retire early? What are my best savings options? Can I afford to pay for my kids' education? Luckily, Empower has all the answers. With Empower's real-time dashboard and real live conversations, you get clarity on your real-life financial goals. So join 18 million Americans and Empower what's next. Start today at empower.com. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more. Sponsored by Empower, not an endorsement or a statement of satisfaction by a client.
I need support staff to clear the room.
Stand up and walk. Now.
Hello and welcome to The Watch. My name is Chris Ryan. I am an editor at TheRinger.com, and joining me on the other line, after a flawless Twitter Spaces session to make a great big announcement, it's Andy Greenwald!
Thank you, and thank you to the patriots of this great country for supporting me. Chris, by the way, I feel like I should be hosting. You're on the other line.
You so rarely host when I'm on the show. You so rarely take the first run.
It's wrong, and I would feel uncomfortable, but you are 5,000, how many more? 6,000 miles apart from each other right now.
A lot of hours. It's 6:15 p.m. here in Stockholm, Sweden. It's bright as noon outside. I'm still trying to get over it. I'm out here for some Spotify meetings, long delayed Spotify meetings since like when The Ringer was acquired. And we're here with a lot of my coworkers. It's great to see you. It's great to see Kaya. I miss you guys, but it's been fun so far.
Chris, what is the Gojo quotient? Like, how similar is it to that episode of Succession? Like, be honest.
They get asked about that a lot.
Yeah,
Succession
bet.
Has been coming up so much. I've been in England and Sweden. And I know that sometimes it's like Succession only has X amount of viewers, but whoever they are, I am around them all the time. All, like, whether it's like they're just bringing it up, whether you overhear people talking about them in a pub, whether you overhear people talking about it online to go to the movies or whatever it is, like, people talk about that show a lot.
But that's the self-selecting 21st century condition. Or in other words, no one knows who built the silo.
That's what I'm saying.
All is that we know is that we
live
inside of
it. Dude, I'm still watching Silo because I'm here. And because nothing works, like, I can't watch many of our favorite streaming services over here. So even as I'm here, like, there's like this huge rush to figure out how to watch Vanderpump among of my coworkers.
How do you say peacock in Swedish?
No habla, man. It doesn't work over here. They're not here yet. So Peacock, Paramount, Max was working. HBO Max was working. And then the other day I was going to watch 100 Foot Wave and it was just like, we've switched to Max and we're now not available in Sweden.
Well, that's a bummer. Also, I thought it was because it would have to be, they'd have to retitle the show in meters. Like, 100 Foot Wave is meaningless, absolutely meaningless in Europe. We have some notes that we want to get through. We want to run through the business of the town, but I should say that later in the show, I'm going to be joined by old friends and frequent watch guests, Josh Schwartz and Stephanie Savage, who brought you such television shows as The OC and Gossip Girl, Looking for Alaska, The Runaways, and are going to be here to talk about their new Apple TV Plus series, City on Fire, which is midway through its run. I think 4 episodes are available out of the 8. So they're going to come on and talk to me once we break the transatlantic and cross-continental connection. So
I want you to ask them about this is an adaptation of a Garth Risk Helberg novel that was set in the 1970s in New York City, but was updated to the 2000s, early 2000s. And it's just got my brain spinning about different novels that I think I want to update, but not quite to the present day, you know?
Oh, absolutely. But also, just think about like the different aesthetics of taking a book that was initially optioned to be set in the 70s, as the book is, around the 77 blackout, and the original screenwriter of the project was our guy Richard Price.
Hell
to
yeah.
Josh and Stephanie, who are magnificently talented and good friends, but are also very, very different than Richard Price, and they updated it to our time, our legendary era of 2003. Quite different.
I was watching the first episode and I saw A1 Records and my heart grew a little bit. It was cool to see some of the sights.
Chris, they resurrected Don Hills, which has been shut for many years and is a club downtown New York that we spent a lot of time in. And apparently it was just locked up and everything was still inside, which is a little disturbing.
So I'm out here. Everybody's talking about Succession. Mm-hmm. Many people are talking. People coming up to me on the street, tears in their eyes saying, sir, mm-hmm. sir. Can you believe that the last great prestige show is ending? And Andy, I just wanted to do a little bit of a temperature check with you before we get to Sunday night's episode. Now, in full disclosure, hilariously enough, I may not be on the final episode of Succession recapping with the watch.
That is a twist.
Just because I don't know when I'm going to be able to see it and what time it will be and whether or not we're going to be able to make time. I will weigh in on this at some point on the watch. But it may not be on Sunday night or Monday night or whenever it is that you do yours.
Does it sway you to know that I've reached out to Elon and his team about setting up the comms to make this possible? Like, do you
is
feel
it
like,
you and DeSantis are going to recap the last ep?
Me and Casey DeSantis, is that what you said? Yes, she's the fun one. It's funny that people are coming up. First of all, people are going to be saying who won the finale of Succession, who lost. I lost.
Yeah.
I lost my guy.
Because it's over?
I lost my number one boy.
I know.
Sunday
it's
night.
So weird.
We'll figure something out and we will have shows for you guys.
Maybe I'll just call you like Cousin Sal used to call Bill.
Yeah. I think that would be great. Now, I won't be recording at the time, but it would be great to hear from you. I think it's interesting that people are coming up to you on the Swedish streets talking about the loss of the show.
Tears in their fika.
People, yeah. People are coming up to me on all sorts of real and virtual streets being like, you absolute dolt, Shiv is the baby of the family. And my 20-minute long run last week about how Roman exhibits baby behavior is completely moot. So
can I ask you a sincere question?
Yeah.
When did we talk about that? After the episode?
Yes, on the Sunday night pod, yes.
Okay, because I have no recollection of you making a big deal about this and people seemed very upset. I was like, did he really...
For what,
like I agreed with you. Also, I thought Roman was the youngest.
For what it's worth, you were on like hour 21 in London. You had adopted not even hour 21. You had adopted a new and controversial sleep schedule of trying to sleep for 2 hour increments over a 40 hour span. So I think I could have said Roman is Mondale the dog in disguise, and you would have been like, "That's a really good point. It's a really strong point." So I would like to apologize about that. I still think I'd like to think my observations about Roman's character and behavior are apt. I'd also like to turn this around and say, well, why isn't it more obvious that Shiv is the baby? I think she's clearly written as the middle child, but maybe that's because she's just the most sensible in some ways and often is the swing vote, which I feel like is kind of middle-ish.
Also, who's to say Succession's not a folk song open to interpretation? I just saw an interview in The Hollywood Reporter with Brian Cox where he was like, maybe Logan's not dead.
Yeah, I think
maybe he just wanted to set this all up so he could see his children's behavior.
Like, I know it's not a specific one-to-one online thing, but Brian Cox is tweeting through it. Like, Brian Cox really liked the press run of 5 weeks ago and is starting to feel a little lonely, and that's kind of interesting to see. You say maybe it's open to interpretation. I would have agreed with you until Casey Bloys, the head of HBO, texted us from Cannes to say he was just talking to Jesse Armstrong and the team of executives to confirm that Shiv is the youngest. So we got fact checked from the top. And thanks everyone for your thoughts and prayers and comments. The other thing we were wrong about before we get into just any finale preview is I was saying that, you know, HBO does have a seemingly unlimited budget. They just plop Hope Davis in, pay her episodic to stand in a pew. And I was like, the place they could have cut corners is they did not put Sophie and Iverson Roy in the SUV on the streets of Manhattan.
But those kids tweeted from the SUV.
They were there. So again, I apologize. I just got a couple things wrong, but you know, we're honest here. So now we can pivot.
I think accountability is what makes this show such a long-running success.
And I think it's what makes...
our show, not Succession.
No, I think accountability is what we look for also in the DeSantis 24 campaign. So...
Are you approaching Sunday night with a... what is it? Is it dread? Is it excitement? Is it melancholy? Is it instant nostalgia for what we've already experienced? What are your feelings going into this last episode? It's been a while since we had one of these. Since we had a finale, a series finale of a long-running show that we talked through a lot of, and that we weren't already like, hey, I think you guys may have driven this car right off the side of a cliff, David Benioff and David Weiss.
I feel very excited because I think, and we'll talk about this in more fully next week, I imagine, we have two shows that are choosing to end at their absolute creative peak, which is Succession and Barry. And the feelings about disappointment or wishing it would come back or they still had some gas in the tank, those will come out over the next few weeks and certainly we'll start feeling it in a year when we kind of wish the show was back. Just the exhilaration of them being like just ripping out the tubes like an ER patient that, you know, like in a movie where they wake up and like, I don't want to be here. I know I've not received the medical care, but I am out of here. I think that's kind of thrilling. And I'm very excited about where it's going to end. I think that it is doing so with like full creative vigor and direction. And, you know, the show is set up to be in a place where everything is cascading down at the same time. So I'm expecting a very, very exciting finale. I don't, you know, there's going to be no sense, I think, of like fan service or petering out. I think I'm steering into the positive of something ending at the top and not waiting for any decline.
Yeah, I think the thing that has really been hitting home for me over the last few weeks, especially even as I think you loved the funeral episode, I think I loved America Decides, not more or less, but they were like, you know, just personal favorites, is I'm going to really miss like how fucking funny this show is.
Yeah.
And what that maybe loses a little bit of its traction when we're kind of caught up in the fan dueling of who is going to come out on top or run the company or, you know, whatever. And I am probably most curious about how this self-engineered final destination for the show, what the consequences are of the drama of the entire series that sort of gets resolved in this episode to the extent that it will be. I don't think that death is the only way to fix anything here or to solve anything. But I do think that if we've had not a critique, but a note of Succession over the last two seasons, especially, it's been, like, you know, nothing really matters. You know, like whatever happens on any given episode tends to like work itself out in the next episode, even if it's just because out of convenience, these characters are placed in the same space again physically and they have to have banter with one another. And that's not going to happen 2 weeks from now. This is it. So what does that mean for how they wrote the series, how they wrote interactions between the characters? Will there actually be a period at the end of the sentence? You know, I mean, I think that with all the like behind the scenes stuff that we've heard from interviews with Jesse, but not even with Jesse, but with some of the actors, it does sound like there was some fluidity in terms of like how they were thinking about this season, whether there would be another season. I'm sure it was written as the final season, but that there might have been some, I don't know, maybe not some ellipses, but some semicolons, you know, where it was like, and then maybe this could have happened. And I wonder if that thinking influences how they write the final episode. I will say, though, that like we've seen some shows end and you're like the penultimate episode was really the end. Mm-hmm. And the last episode is the like everybody having their final conversation and their hug, aka Breaking Bad, I think, to some extent. This does not feel that way. I feel like there's still a lot more plot they have to get through. There's still a lot more deal making. I think there's going to be a lot of Skarsgård based on the trailer. So I'm very excited for it. But I have I'm very curious to see it whenever I actually do.
I've realized that maybe it's due to my somewhat nervous disposition that I'm generally loath to make very loud public predictions or pronouncements. But considering how confident I was that the San Antonio Spurs were winning the draft lottery last week, but somehow,
and just also about the birth order of the Roy children.
Yeah,
I
put myself out on Front Street in the wrong way.
And you were also just like Ron going to Twitter is a brave new step into the future, which really that walks hand in hand with some of his core tenets of his campaign.
Yeah, but I back channeled that one. I communicated my approval. There are a couple things that I feel pretty confident about. One, broadly, is that I'll just say it. I think I'm right about what the show is ultimately about in the broad strokes. And what I mean by that is, and this is natural, I'm not saying this is the wrong thing to do. This is fun. This is one of the reasons why we love serialized TV. But I do think that conversations about who's going to win, about who's going to lose, about who's going to end and on the top, I think are a little bit misguided. I don't think this is a show that is going to, you know, as you point about death being the thing, I don't think people are going to end up in the grave in this episode, literally. I don't think that it's
according to Brian Cox, there might be some people jumping out of the grave like the Undertaker.
I would love that. And so would he. I think that the consistent message has been that this is kind of a poison chalice and that you can, quote unquote, win the title of CEO, but what is your empire? What is what are the ruins that you're ruling over, and what has become of your soul or your connections to anyone else who've known you? So it still seems most likely to me that Kendall becomes his father to a degree. That seems like the trajectory we've always been on and the trajectory that was brought into clear focus last week. So if we're going to get into like the prediction game of that, I think that makes sense. But what that means for everyone else.
I agree with you. I agree with you with while I'm also willing to be completely surprised.
I would love to be surprised. I think the one question mark to me, and again, I think that this hasn't been the nature of the show, so I don't think we'll do it, but is there going to be any flash forward or glance at the future or even just sort of suggestion of the future? Or will
I think they should go full 6 feet under and down to the use of the Sia song, you know, like just bang that jam and then have like... What happens is Kendall is like, you know, in 2062, you know?
Well, I think that's also, that's the question, because as to your point about like nothing mattering if the show just continued on and reversing itself in the pursuit of good jokes and good drama, I think ending now makes sense because I feel like it's baked in. Whatever end point Jesse chooses has to feel significant, because I think underneath that is the sense that these are people who cannot change, who cannot be happy, and will continue to wriggle and squirm for potentially decades, you know, in an attempt to kind of fix the problems inside of themselves. So where he puts the period at the end of the sentence is going to be particularly, is everything. I mean, that's a pretty obvious observation to make. But I'm really curious to see how he does it within the framework of what I predict will be a standard episode of Succession, in that it won't suddenly go wobbly and montage-y at the end. I don't think so either. I think the house style has been very successful, so we'll stick with it.
What else is happening in the town, man? Like, I'm so far removed from the streets. I'm so far removed from what's happening inside of Silicon Valley / Hollywood
I think that's the problem. I did want to just touch on one little kerfluffle from this week that I thought was interesting. It lasted about 18 hours. Which I believe is the time difference between us. So it probably didn't happen to you at all. But as you alluded to, HBO Max became Max this week. And one of the victims of the transition was the traditional credit order that has been guild mandated and understood within movies and TV for decades. So someone pointed this out on Twitter. It went viral. People started noticing that instead of, you know, if you'd look at, I'm just going to pull an example. I don't even know if it was on there, but like, Taxi Driver, it didn't say director Martin Scorsese, screenwriter Paul Schrader. It said creators, and it listed Scorsese and Schrader and all the executive producers, as if everybody had done the same thing, and who did what didn't matter.
Yeah.
And this was pointed out, people got very upset, and Max Corporate pivoted very quickly from digitally deleting the boos of college students from David Zaslav's commencement speech last week to handling this next crisis, which was by saying, oh, this was an oversight, like, you know, it was a rush to transfer things and it was a UI thing and we'll address it. Now, first of all, they had to say that because, as I said, credits are guild mandated and there would have been legal action if Martin Scorsese was not listed as the director of the movies he directed. So, of course, they were going to say that. I do think it's significant. I do think it matters because it strikes me as saying the quiet part
loud. The credits are the mistake.
The mistake.
Yeah.
Because I think it is a very, very noisy, even if it was accidental, tell as to what the tech corporate overlords think of what business they're in, which is to say that Taxi Driver, Vanderpump Rules, Last Chance Kitchen, Bluey, whatever, this is content. It's just content. It's just stuff that goes in boxes. And the people who make content are no different than people on TikTok. They're just content creators doing their best to just fill the void. And it seems prissy or highfalutin or even just old-fashioned to be like, hey, I wrote that. Those are my words. Or I'm interested in who wrote that because I might want to see other words that they wrote. And I found it very dispiriting, and hopefully kind of a flashing warning light to our good friends in the Directors Guild, for example, who are currently negotiating with the same AMPTP that the writers are striking from.
I don't really have a take on this as much as my joke about the Silicon Valley / Hollywood thing was not really a joke, because one thing that I think is becoming really apparent to folks who are following lack of negotiations, the straight up, like the labor issues afflicting Hollywood right now, is the sort of influence of Silicon Valley / tech companies on the movie and television making business. And that the thing that we grew up thinking of as Hollywood and the levers of power in making movies and television are really now, for the most part, subservient to, if not literally, tech companies like Apple and Amazon or Netflix. They think like tech companies, and they have to think like tech companies because they're making technology products in a lot of way. And culturally, in my experience, technology moves at a different pace and with a different set of standards. It's not a qualitative judgment, but a different set of standards than, say, the idea that you might have in your head of how at a movie studio, there are departments for everything and everybody is like, all I do is take still photographs on sets and then think about how they should be serviced to publications. Mm-hmm. Or all I do is make sure that the tiniest edge of a font looks good when we blow it up to billboard size and put it in Times Square or whatever. And I don't know necessarily that engineers who move technology products think about things in the same way. When you think about when you get an iPhone update and then you get another one because it's fixing the bugs in the previous update. And you're right. It could be very much, a shot across the bow at quote unquote creators and how they're viewed by technology companies. But it could also be that, like, that was a bug in the update that they rolled out. And now they're doing it, which isn't to say it's good, because you can see the cultural clash
between
these two things. And it actually is a little bit chilling, because you have to imagine that that's going to make it even more difficult going down the line for these people to find common ground.
I totally agree with that. I don't think there was malice behind this. I think it would have been, it beggars belief that they would provoke the guilds, like, as they're sitting down trying to negotiate with them. I mean, they're not sitting down with the writers, but they are sitting down with the directors at this moment. And nobody cares about a directed by or a film by credit like directors do. So, and Leslie Linka Glatter, the veteran director who's head of the DGA, was incensed and, commented on it immediately. But I do think that it's a very revealing mistake about the culture clash and the cultural divide that may be ultimately impossible to bridge. And then I just think, there's just little movements that people who are industry watchers just should keep an eye on. I mean, there's no news from the writer's strike. Like, as Mike Schur, who's one on the negotiating committee and the veteran showrunner, whose new show with our buddy Shea Serrano, Primo, is on Freevee now. I can't wait to check it out. He, as he said in an interview recently, he's like, Sherman Oaks isn't that far away. Like, they will go negotiate with the studios as soon as the studios ask to negotiate again, but they're focused on the directors right now. But I think there is unanimity in the sense that people believe whatever is on the other side of this is going to be different. And that might be different only inside the industry before it reaches outside the industry. But you just look at little things. You look at this, and then the next piece of news that's in Deadline is that the co-heads of Scripted at Our Baby, AMC, veteran programmers who have good relationships with people in the town and have worked on successful shows for AMC, Emma Miller and Carrie Galluli, are jointly leaving AMC to go work at Netflix.
Right before we took over.
Now, some people say we leaned on them, and I think that's unfair. We are strong but firm. We are not Logans, we are Ewans, I think, in that we are ultimately, on the side of good. We're just a little crusty. Maybe we don't, present well in meetings. But genuinely, like, this is a specific instance. Their decisions are their own. It is probably unfair to just turn that into tea leaves. But you just notice that, like, who which fish can survive in this shrinking ocean. This doesn't mean AMC is done. I hope not. You know, it's not necessarily pulling a thread that will lead to something, but you just should notice they didn't displace the current heads of Scripted at Netflix. They just got added to the team because Netflix makes a lot more stuff than other people do. And so, you know, just noting it like you would with an anxious thought or feeling. You note it.
I have nothing really else to hit you with. You know, I know that Quentin Tarantino's at Cannes. He announced that his film, next and last feature film, will be The Critic, which has been this much discussed idea. Initially, some people thought it was going to be about Pauline Kael. It turns out it's going to be about a movie critic who works at a pornography magazine in the 1970s.
That seems right.
And then the only other bit that I saw today before we got on was just that Citadel, and I really bring this up for you, has been renewed for season two. I know that was a real... They were kind of, the ref was underneath the tarp looking at that one in instant replay for a while. But it's coming back season two, and Joe Russo is going to be directing the entire season.
It's so great. I mean, that alone just gets me fired up. You know, that he was just like, it's Al Pacino in Godfather 3, you know? He was ready to just cruise into retirement, legacy of great work. And he was like, no, this story needs me. This is what I need to turn my attention to. So, look, I mean, this is still part of the same conversation we're having. Like, I think Citadel is pretty objectively and subjectively awful, but it's probably very successful. I don't know if it's successful, like, to justify the cost, but then again, the cost doesn't really matter to Amazon in terms of what its objectives are globally. So this was fait accompli that it was going to get renewed. And so the great work goes on. I thought you were going to bring up the fact that Blur made a surprise new album and the first single's really good. But, you know, if I was hosting the show, I would have led with that and then just watch the listeners just...
Watch the listens go down. No, I like to front load with really important news, like us commenting on Ron DeSantis's Twitter announcement 48 hours later.
And just like things we got wrong about Succession last week. Because it's the only thing better than podcasts are podcasts about podcasts. The re-listenables.
Andy, I can't wait to listen to you and Josh and Stephanie talk about City on Fire. I'm going to check out some more episodes as my vacation continues. Well, my vacation really starts. I was still working here, you know. It's just this is the idea of dispersed workforce, you know, or, you know, like I'm remote.
We're not judging you. We haven't seen, Kai and I were talking about it, we haven't seen too many pictures of like Aperol spritzes at midday on your social media feeds.
Well, I am going to go get a Negroni. So it was great to see you. It was great to see Kaya briefly. And I can't wait to listen to your interview with Josh Schwartz and Stephanie Savage.
Honesty, integrity, Ryan 24. And we will be back in some form. We will have a podcast after the Succession finale, and we will have more podcasts next week in the wake of the end of Succession and Barry. But now, let's get into my interview with Josh and Stephanie.
This episode is brought to you by Mint Mobile. If you've had it with your overpriced wireless plan with its insanely high monthly bill and unexpected overages, then listen to this. For a limited time, wireless plans from Mint Mobile are $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan. That's unlimited talk, text, and data for $15 a month. Wow, right? To get this new customer offer, just go to mintmobile.com/watch. That's mintmobile.com/watch. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first three-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for more details.
This episode is brought to you by Vuori. I love sports. I know you do too. I also know that lots of you exercise. But if you're like me and my wife, the beloved sports gal, you're sick and tired of ugly, uncomfortable workout gear, especially, you know, I do a lot of walking. I walk around LA, I make calls, I listen to podcasts. Here are two words that will change everything. Vuori Clothing, a line of activewear that is unbelievable. The best thing about Vuori is you can lounge around in it, you can work out in it, you can go outside, you can go shopping down in your local wherever, and you never feel like you're either underdressed or overdressed. You're just comfortable. You can wear it when you're training, traveling, lounging around the house. Go get yourself some of the most comfortable and versatile clothing on the planet. Here's the deal. Our listeners get 20% off their first purchase at Vuori.com/Simmons. Once again, Vuori.com/Simmons.
This episode is brought to you by Empower. You got money questions like, can I retire early? What are my best savings options? Can I afford to pay for my kids' education? Luckily, Empower has all the answers. With Empower's real-time dashboard and real live conversations, you get clarity
on your real life financial goals. So join 18 million Americans and Empower What's Next. Start today at empower.com. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more. Sponsored by Empower, not an endorsement or a statement of satisfaction by a client. This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. We're not all professional athletes, but we all have health goals. That's why Anytime Fitness gives you access to personalized plans and support from a coach. Plus, you can track your training, nutrition, and recovery progress with the Anytime Fitness app, just like the pros. With 24/7 access to more than 5,000 gyms worldwide, get more from your gym membership. Visit anytimefitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, restrictions all apply. See website for details.
Okay, now I'm thrilled to be joined once again by old friends of both me and the podcast, Josh Schwartz and Stephanie Savage. Welcome to what I feel like it's the fifth studio you've spoken to me in over the years. And how do you feel about this one?
Very, very personal. Love what you've done with the place.
Thank you. Yeah. Yes.
Is that your rock garden in the hallway?
Yes. Yeah. I'm the one that came up with the name Studio Six. I just thought that really had a nice, catchy thing that made people feel comfortable. Thrilled to have you guys in. We're going to talk about your new Apple TV Plus series, City on Fire, and a bunch of other things. But right at the top, we should say the circumstances of this interview. It's a funny time in Hollywood. We ran into
funny.
Each other. Not funny, haha. Funny like Joe Pesci in Goodfellas, funny. We ran into each other on the picket line last week or the week before. And
at the Paramount Studios.
And talked about what was going on and how maybe we could still find a way to talk during all of this.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely different people have different perspectives on behavior during the strike. I think for us, the show premiered 2 weeks ago, post-strike. Yeah. And out of solidarity with our guild, we did not attend our premiere. We did not attend our press junket that Apple put on. We did not attend our FYC event. But because we've been friends for close to 20 years now, we felt like this was a safe space to talk.
Yeah, we kind of got to know each other the same year that the show is set, which gives us a lot of things to talk about.
It's kind of shocking. I was the first thing. I mean, look, I was always going to be in the tank for this because I was in New York in that particular tank during the era the show is set. And we should say that City on Fire is based on the novel by Garth Risk-Hallberg that was quite popular when it was published a few years ago. And that book is very much about downtown New York City and the music scene, but it is set during the blackout summer of 1977. You have, I think, very cleverly and successfully updated the book to another memorable blackout summer in which there was a lot of good music downtown, which was the summer of 2003. Summer 2003 is when the OC premiered. So
yeah.
I think that's pretty trippy. Like, this era is both nostalgia for us, but also very much lived experience, right? Talk to me about the decision to pick that era and also how quite different I think your 2003 was from the characters in this show.
Well, I had read the book originally when it came out. Josh and I were both very interested in it when it got published just because of, you know, the world it was set in and how it was described. We both bought it.
It sat on my bedside table for several years.
And it makes an impact. It is an extremely big book.
Like, it's a nice doorstop, paperweight. Yeah.
It's got stuff inside that you can look at even if you don't read it.
That's true. Mm-hmm. So that's why you recommended it to Josh, because you knew if it was not illustrated, he never
pictures,
would have picked it up.
And when I read it, I was really struck by, to me, what felt like, oh, makes such a great, like, limited series or sort of a long-form narrative if it was adapted, because you could kind of organize the material in a different way. You could pull out the mystery and the investigation, and that, to me, I was sort of starting to see, like, a clean through line of that. But then, of course, it was not available because a big part of the narrative of the book is that it was bought in galleys by Scott Rudin's optioned by Scott Rudin's company to adapt as a feature.
Yeah, although you thought maybe it was an FX series as well.
I think it started as a feature. I think everything Scott Rudin
starts used,
when he always would, he famously would do a lot of things, but famously with books, he would go in galleys and say, like, I'm going to make a major motion picture, Oscar winning thing with this. And then often they would not come to fruition, because how do you turn Cavalier and Clay by Michael Chabon into a two-hour movie? And I think there's now some of those projects moved to TV, and I think that version of it was maybe set up at FX for a while as a potential miniseries.
Yeah,
but
interesting.
Anyway, it shook free.
It did. And so when we originally got our deal at Apple, we just made this big, long list of, like, everything that don't worry about like if we have access to it, if it's available, if we can afford it, just like what are some projects that we'd love to do? And that was, it was on the list, and it turned out that it had become available. So then we started talking.
Then Stephanie's like, now you must read this book.
There was no more avoiding it.
There was no more avoiding it.
And the 1970s is like a pretty big lift for production. Like it's mm-hmm. very expensive and time consuming. A lot of resources go into recreating that, especially New York in the 70s is like virtually impossible without, you know, a lot of visual effects. And
where do they shoot The Mandalorian? I feel like you would have a better opportunity to recreate 1970s New York.
You could do that on The Volume.
Yeah,
I think it would feel real weird.
But. Yeah.
So there was that issue. There's also like for a younger audience, the 1970s is now a very long time ago.
Sadly, even for some of us in this room, it feels increasingly like a long time ago.
Yeah.
And then we were also talking about how when Garth was writing the book, he was kind of using the 1970s as a way to talk about the period of the early 2000s in New York City. And we were like, well, we could kind of flip that and we could use, could actually set it then. And then when we realized that like, well, there was a blackout in the summer of 2003, that really got us thinking about like, maybe this would be possible and it could be a really fun way to bring in all the things we love about the book, but update it in a way that still felt relevant. And we also had a lot of conversations about kind of that time period in New York. And now that having 20 years have passed since 9/11, that people would feel comfortable with storytelling in that space and not feel like it was too soon or exploitative or.
Yeah. And we thought it would be, as Steph was saying, an easier lift production wise. And how different does New York look now than it did in 2003? And then COVID hit and suddenly we were like, what are we going to do with all these outdoor eating shelter shacks, whatever they're called, and e-bikes.
All the yurts and things.
Yeah, there's all these, there was some stuff kind of post-COVID. But in the same way, you know, as Steph was saying, 1970s New York was a period where people were not sure if New York was going to survive. Post 9/11, people were not sure if New York was going to survive as a city. And when we started working on this during COVID, it was another kind of existential moment for New York. So all these time periods were kind of speaking to each other and echoing each other thematically in a way that was interesting to us as well.
I also just found like the spirit of adaptation really appealing, right? Because I just generally think that books are books and they exist and everyone should read them and enjoy them, even Josh sometimes. And finding what you as creative people connect to in it and love about it or are intrigued by it, and then being able to take that for a ride is, you know, helps the spirit of the piece. And you can feel that in the pilot of what you guys did.
And when we went to Garth with it and we said, hey, what do you think if we, you know, updated and changed the time period, he was actually very excited about it and was like, that's what adaptation is for. The book is the book and the TV series is going to be its own thing. And so his support actually gave us a lot of wind in our sails to move forward.
I mean, his middle name is Risk, right? I mean, like he was ready for it. So just drilling down a little bit, like what was, you said there was, I mean, it's a one-to-one thing. There's a blackout, there's a music scene. Mm-hmm. What were the more challenging things, separate and apart from production values, that you felt were difficult in terms of finding the analog for 2003 or finding, you know, grounding the book in 2003?
Well, we also wanted to kind of pull through that thread of the 1970s that was in the book, which we wanted to do in a subtle way with the production design and the costume design. And thinking about how the characters would be pulling that thread themselves and the idea that the city brought in, it sort of brought people to it that were looking for that kind of experience. Like everyone is nostalgic for like New York in the 70s.
Yeah.
Even if you completely missed the boat on that, you're trying to kind of pastiche that experience and bring it into your own world. So thinking about how we could do that with how we built the phalanstery and how we kind of had this idea that somewhere in that house is this giant pile of like thrift store clothing that everyone just kind of put on in the morning and built their looks. And then also in thinking about the music.
I think that's so smart too, because at the time being in New York, like what everyone was obsessed with was 1981. Which was 20 years before, and except when you yourself are in your early 20s, that basically is like the Victorian era.
Yeah.
And so now from this vantage point, being like, that really wasn't that long ago. And the people who were in ESJ were probably working their day jobs being like, oh, people care now? Yeah. You know, it's not exactly like everything is cleanly partitioned to be one era or another. It's right. always in a conversation with itself.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And the idea that people are always nostalgic for the moment of New York that they feel they missed, yeah. you know? So now, obviously, there's a, you know, a lot of the actors in the show, the younger actors, were born around this period, like Wyatt Olaf was born in 2003.
That's tough. It's such tough to hear it.
And, yeah. and Chase Sweewonders is only a couple years older than that. And so, you know, they're nostalgic for this period of New York, you know, and Jemima Kirk lived through this period very vividly and talks about it, mm-hmm. you know, and was probably at Don Hills and up to stuff. And, you know, for her, that's like the last moment that New York was cool. You know, yeah. that's her perspective now. Of course, it was also the year that CBGB's turned into a John Varvatos. So there were people who had been there since the 70s who would look at that period as like the beginning of the end. And that's what's interesting about that New York experience is everyone gets there and feels like they just missed it.
Yeah, there was no moment during my time in New York where I felt like I got it. This is right. like I was mm-hmm. here to receive it. And I was yeah. there 99 to 2016. Everybody was just trying to, you know, well, we'll do our best. But there's always the person right before you sort of looking down their glasses being like, you don't know what it used to
you
be
don't
like.
Know. Yeah. Yeah, and that period kind of post 9/11, pre-Occupy Wall Street, it's a really fertile, interesting time in New York, in the country. It's just, it felt like a rich time to set the show. And then obviously we've talked a bit about, you know, Meet Me in the Bathroom, where you are featured, thanked.
I'm a talking head. Yeah. I'm in there talking about all the times I missed going to Miss Shapes. Like I was like kind of like what's the reverse Zelig where I was just outside. And didn't quite make it in.
And that book also was like a really wonderful book, but also really made it feel like that was a moment. And that is a moment that's worth kind of, even as a backdrop in the show, chronicling. So,
yeah, I think the thing about, and shout out to my friend Lizzie Goodman, who wrote mm-hmm. that great book, like what's, it's kind of amazing to talk to everyone in that and realize that moment, most of those bands didn't quite make it. Like, it's the story of bands who almost did and had a moment or fumbled it or were popular insularly, you know? Mm-hmm. It's not really, history isn't really written by the winners always.
No, and as the inspiration for our band in the show, mm-hmm. Jonathan Fireeater was kind of one of the big inspirations that we talked about with Jonathan Leahy, our music supervisor, yep. in figuring out the sound for this band.
So I think the other thing that I really enjoyed and appreciated about the show is I think you keenly understand something, which is that an era isn't a TV show. One of the things that I really loved about the pilot particularly is just I think it's really well constructed, not to get too inside baseball about it, but it's really brilliantly constructed and it's really dynamic and it's remarkable how efficient it is in terms of introducing these strands of the world, introducing the importance of a band and then showing us the band and getting through it all in that first hour. What was the process like for you guys? You've been working together now for, as we said, for two decades. Mm-hmm. What was it like saddling up again and trying to tackle something like this and turning it into just in the context of that first hour?
Well, it was a big project because I think the sort of what I felt reading the book the first time and then revisiting it, like really with our thinking caps on, really going like, okay,
we do have actual thinking caps.
Oh, are they matching?
Yeah.
Or
mm-hmm. yeah, they're like a
that's cute
little sleeping cap. Sorry.
Yeah.
That's because you go to sleep and then Stephanie
Stephanie does all the work and I wake up and it's done.
Yeah, incredible.
I don't have to read the book.
That idea that like there was sort of this beautiful mind map of how to like adapt the show turned out to not be true. Like mm-hmm. the beautiful mind map was like phase one and then there were like 11 more phases. And that became pretty clear as soon as we started writing that as much as we had in our minds kind of cleared out like and winnowed down the story that there was still more story that and more characters that needed to come out. So that mm-hmm. was sort of the next phase. And then figuring out how to start the story in a way where you were introducing everyone and unlike a book that has chapters where this chapter is about this person, this chapter is about mm-hmm. that person, we were never going to get through the story if we didn't start weaving all the storylines together.
And pulling them tighter.
And pulling them right. tighter, yeah.
And also, we ended up writing this ourselves. It's the first time we didn't have a writer's room, mm-hmm. Which may not be an option moving forward, depending on how this all goes with the strike. But that was just because it was COVID mm-hmm. when we first started. The idea of doing a Zoom room, we had other shows that were doing a Zoom room, and they just felt really challenging. And the book is so long, it's like 900 pages, that we felt like by the time anyone else finished the book, we would have already broken a lot mm-hmm. of the season. So it's the first time that we've ever just kind of done it the two of us, which was a really fun, exciting challenge that we will never do again, regardless
of what happens.
We figured
out finally how to use the collaboration feature on Final Draft.
This is some really inside baseball. Yeah.
That is a scary tab. I'm very impressed that you cracked that code. You could like teach a seminar.
And, you know, every adaptation is different. You know, this book, obviously, we keep talking about is voluminous, and mm-hmm. there's a lot of characters, and there were some major characters that we actually excised out of the book and gave their role to some of the other characters mm-hmm. who were in the book so they would have more agency. William, you know, character in particular, kind of absorbed one of the other major characters from the book that we cut. But, like, when we were adapting Looking for Alaska, that was obviously a book where, first of all, some people view it as a, you know that book inside mm-hmm. and out. And if you don't include this one line, you've ruined the whole thing.
It's a sacred text.
It's a sacred text. But that was really about addition, you mm-hmm. know? It was about how do we fill the book out and go to some places and change some and break from the perspective of the book and fill out some of those supporting characters. And this was a different task. This was about kind of not whittling, but sort of molding the clay in a different way. You know, subtraction, I guess, is the simplest way of putting it.
And I think that one of the most remarkable things for me as a fan of your work over a period of time is I don't know if you see the clip of like, how does he keep getting away with it? Like, how do you guys keep finding generationally appealing, talented, attractive people to be in these shows? Like, you know, it's as true of City on Fire as it was with Looking for Alaska or The OC or Gossip Girl. Like, it is really casting dependent, I think, in a way, because you have to, and it's very, very hard to find young people who can carry the load of some of the stuff that you guys write or that people want to watch. Chase Wee Wonders and Wyatt Olaf, who I was not familiar with either of them before, are fantastic. And immediately I was like, I'm interested in them, even though I don't understand the full tapestry of what they're involved in. Have you got this casting down to a science now, or is it dumb luck every time?
Well, shout out to Patrick Rush, our casting director.
It starts with the right person in that job.
Who did OC with us, who did Looking for Alaska, did Chuck with us, who did Runaways and now City on Fire. So we've worked with him over many, many years. Shout out to David and Lindsay, who did Gossip Girl casting. But he has a great eye for this and knows kind of, he's just keeping tabs of who's out there, who's bubbling, who's ready to have their moment. It was interesting because this was our first time casting entirely on Zoom. Mm. And so we had to do a chemistry read with Wyatt and Chase. And you're like, how are you going to do a chemistry read on Zoom? Like, how could that possibly work? And yet there was chemistry. So if there can be, if chemistry is happening on Zoom, then it's probably going to happen when we're all together on screen.
So what was it like navigating with Wyatt this world? Like, was it like telling him he's going to be in Westeros? Like,
we've gotten kind of used to this, I will say, because we had this a bit. We've had this a bit now as we started. We were in the same generation as the actors that we were working with, and obviously now it feels like we have the fireside chat, and these actors like sit at our feet and are like, "Tell us about the aughts. What was it like?" So we've kind of gotten used to that role.
Do you invite them over to sit on the Teen Choice Awards surfboard?
We do.
Just have in your office.
We hand them a trio, and then we go from there. We give them a Zune.
Be like, no, eyebrows. That was on purpose. Yeah. Like, that's what we were all doing. Speaking of like just the sort of generational shift. So, as you said, like there's an energy to things like The OC where it was like kind of. I mean, no one on the production side was in high school at the time, but not the age difference wasn't too far apart. Mm-hmm. It is farther apart now. Do you find yourself having a different interest in the young people's stories in these stories as you are telling them at this point in life?
I don't know that we have a different interest in them.
Perspective, I guess. Interest is the wrong word.
I think we're still super compelled by those stories. I will say, especially Josh, having experience as a parent, we're maybe a little better at those stories than we were in The OC.
Although The OC, we did come from a very pro-parent perspective, and it was so far from where we were in our lives at that time. But there is a moment where you start to go, there's that moment when the actor comes in to read for the parent role, even on the CW, where it's a young parent, and you're like, oh my God, I could now be playing the parent on this particular show. I think you definitely start to identify with some of those stories. But we love having these young actors around and getting their experience and trying to weave as much of them and their personality and what's interesting to them into the shows as well. I think we like to listen.
And I think like working with Jemima on this was really interesting because she was sort of having that experience of like, oh, if this was, you know, not even maybe 10 years ago, but like 5 years ago, like I might be playing.
Yeah. She literally was a girl not too long ago. Exactly. Now she's a woman and mother.
Yeah. And then using some of that in the story, like we rewrote the first big fight that she has with her husband, Keith, to include a reference of like, you know, I was that girl and then I'd strangled her so we could have this, that idea of like growing up and putting some of that like carefreeness, that, you know, exuberance, that selfishness away to be an adult and then feeling that like you're kind of getting punished for that, or you're like, now something's missing from you that you gave up in pursuit of something else, which that kind of a story felt sort of unique and timely, I'd say, to kind of where we are in our lives.
Yeah, no, we have different perspectives on some of how these things can play out in adulthood.
But also New York as a city of perpetual youth and the promise of perpetual excitement in youth, and that's in the show as well. And like, you know, Keith goes downtown, you know, I should have said this at the beginning, but like, we're not really going to spoil. I think we haven't, and I don't see any reason to spoil particular episodes. We're
just the end
when we're recording. Yeah. it was all a dream.
I mean, the big tip off for Regan, for Jemima's character, that Keith is up to no good is that he's listening to the Libertines.
Oh my God. Yeah. I wanted to talk. There are these little things where I'm like, okay, they're flipping through the vinyl and the one behind the record that's important is the Thrills, So Long to the City or whatever. I'm like, yeah, I played Big Sur recently. It's a pretty good track. Someone's paying attention back there. And I do have to, you mentioned the Club Don Hills, which was the site of, like, I think Misshapes started there, but Tiz was the big club night there before. And I think broadly Josh got it right when he said that people were there up to no good. I think it was primarily an up to no good spot.
I'm just going off of what I've heard you say about the scene.
Yeah. Oh no, that's right. I'm the guy you go to. You resurrected it. Like you went there and you filmed there and it was there. Is this accurate?
Yeah, I mean, it was basically there. It was kind of like a storage facility. Like, it was a lot of just tables on top of things, but it was there. And Aaron Osborne, our production designer, got very into like recreating it and bringing it back to its 2003 glory, down to the wallpaper. That is the actual wallpaper that was on the wall in 2003.
Yeah, they reproduced it. And Jesse Peretz, our director, had spent a lot of time in there as well. And so he also was like, this wasn't over there, it was over here. And like the wallpaper, and we actually cut a scene that took place in the bathroom, but the wallpaper in the bathroom was the same. And so
a lot of stuff happened in those bathrooms.
Well, by the way, I was going to say, every single person in our crew who was around in that era was like, man, I spent some time in the bathroom at this place. And we're like,
yep,
those walls could talk.
That's actually something worth talking about, is that I think this show, more than any other, was one where we really went to the crew and said, like, bring your own experience to this. It started with a conversation around 9/11, which we had at the very beginning of the show in our first big concept meeting, to just say, like, normally it wouldn't be the case that, like, if you're the prop master, people are going to ask you to weigh in on the wardrobe or the set design. But, like, if anything feels ever like we're not being respectful, or something feels thrown away in a way that doesn't feel good to you, like, speak up. If you have a personal story that you want to share, that you want to incorporate, speak up. On the first day that we started shooting, we actually did the Charlie Sam walk by of Ground Zero, and we had a moment of silence at the top of that day, and Bobby Kennedy, our AD, gave a really lovely speech.
But always count on a Kennedy.
Totally. Those Kennedys give good speeches.
Depends which Kennedy we're talking
about. That's true. It's less
a political moment. It might be great trickier. No relation.
So Bobby. It started with that. And then it also just kind of went into like the Don Hills experience. It went to the Lower East Side experience. And people were really activated to just bring themselves and put themselves in the show and the work they were doing, whether it was like the on-set painter doing the graffiti, or some of the people that we reached out to be like our ghost artist, or everyone was just like there and bringing their own experience in a way that I think made that part of the show feel really rich and really dense, because no one was relying on like the internet to like tell them what to think about something.
I also imagine that's good in a way, like anti-COVID measures, in terms of like the chill of being separated for so long, that we can actually bring everyone in with their own enthusiasm and their own invested interest. And I mean, obviously I can only speak from my perspective, but I appreciated that in the show, which is to say that like at the age that I was and that some of the characters were when 9/11 happened, it was fucking horrible, but it was also horrible in a crazy distancing way. I was lucky enough not to be personally touched by it. It was just the city I lived in, and you went on with it thinking, I guess this is what happens when you're 23 or 24. And then there's concentric circles beyond that, that adults, and I think as an adult now, it would have been much more affected by it, just mm-hmm. because of this, my feeling of being connected to the world and everything like that. I think that it was well done in terms of how present it was for some characters versus others.
Yeah, and you're always going to be careful not to be exploitative. And, you know, it is a time period, as Steph was saying earlier, where it's been 20 years, but for a lot of people, it still feels like yesterday, and it's still a little bit of a third rail to even try to to draw some elements from in a fictional storytelling context. So it was something that we you know, tread gently and as respectfully as we could.
I guess in the spirit of nostalgia and looking back, I wonder if the experience of making the show and being like deep into 2003 from these characters' perspective and from just a New York perspective has caused you to have any different thoughts about the OC, which is now 20 years old. It's funny to think about how our art is always looking backwards to a degree, even if it's set in the present, because what informed you, Josh, in terms of the creation of the OC was things that had filled you before that point, you know? And so to think about those characters coming home, if they ever come home, so far through four episodes, they don't go home very often, but if they did and turning on Fox at night, they would be seeing Seth Cohen, which is like a world away, even though it's all 2003.
Yeah. And we actually, funny, we set Looking for Alaska in 2005, which is when the book was published. And it just felt like it was hard to imagine those characters living in a post Instagram world, just the way they were rendered in the book. And we did have a moment where one of the characters is watching. You hear a little bit of the theme song in the background as a reference. Here, it did not feel like these people were watching the OC at night.
Or had televisions.
Yeah, they weren't coming home for appointment viewing. I
know. We were just kind of, I guess we're going to become like Oliver Stone was to the 60s. That's going to be us to like the TRL era, which, you know, That's a corner for us.
He's had a long career.
Yeah.
I think you would have to make a movie called The Libertines, right?
Right. Just to go at a conspiracy theory about what happened to them. I think we know what happened to them.
Why we do. What has your relationship with the OC been like recently? Because I know that Rachel Bilson and she was co-hosting with
Clark.
Doing a rewatch podcast that you guys were involved with or guested on as well. What has that been like to be nostalgic about something that I imagine doesn't feel too distant?
It's been great. I mean, I will say the, again, a little bit with COVID and pandemic, just that idea of like reaching back out to people who were important in your life and just because of how life goes kind of can fall away. That was already in motion. And the podcast really, I think, just accelerated that. And we have now been back in touch with people that we hadn't talked to in a really long time on the show. I think the most surprising thing for us is when the show ended, I think we were like, well, that failed. You know, that was my takeaway. Just, it was a bumpy road.
About the whole project or the way it ended?
I mean, I had a hard time kind of separating those two ideas. It's just like, it ended, I fucked this up, and, you know, that's on me, and I'm going to hang my head in shame. And then we moved on very quickly, and we were doing other stuff. But I think the thing that's been really wonderful and been very helpful with perspective is that it feels like more people want to talk to us about the OC now than they did even when it was first on. And either because it means more to people now as they get older when they look back on that time in their lives, or because of streaming, just how many more people can discover the show or rewatch the show. And so the fact that like we made something and 20 years later, people still want to talk about it, say they still listen to the music from it, or it helped shape their musical identity, or they married this person because they reminded them of Seth Cohen, or which we've heard.
A few times,
yeah. Or like they go down there and try to find some of the, you know, some of the pier, the diner, the bait shop. They're not going to find the bait shop, but they can look. That's really kind of been really gratifying. And so the podcast, the idea that we also got to hear from the actors and their experiences and how much it meant to them as well. Because when these shows end, everybody feels like they're just trying to get out of there, you know, by the end, cast-wise. And so I think everybody now has had the opportunity to kind of appreciate that show as an important chapter in the sort of, in their careers and lives.
Yeah, and some of those things that we feel like we failed at the end of the day, if you created something that people, you know, love watching and are still talking about 20 years later, maybe that's not a failure.
Exactly.
I think it's not.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, and again, that's just also the fog of war, I think, when you're in it and you're just living and dying by all that stuff, you kind of, but now that we've had this opportunity, yeah, to see the big picture.
Also, too, I would say the pandemic and how, like, streaming content actually, like, helps sustain people through a really, really difficult period that, especially early on, we were very much associated with, like, guilty pleasures,
yes.
You know, whether that was the OC or Gossip Girl or maybe even Chuck to some degree. But knowing that those were big pandemic rewatch shows and that they actually like help people feel grounded and safe and comfortable in a scary time kind of reframes that notion of what a guilty pleasure is to something that's like just a pleasure and just makes you feel safe.
I think
and
we got
cozy.
It. We literally won an award for the OC called the VH1 Guilty Pleasure of the Year Award. And I remember when we received it, I was like, is this good? Do we want to win this award? And now you're like, hell yeah, I would take them all.
That I feel like, I mean, I hope that idea is just so dated, like of a guilty pleasure.
Yeah.
Like life is too fleeting to worry about anything if it's
pleasure.
Like, yeah, like, as long as no one's hurt, that's
pizza's
fine.
Pizza's a guilty pleasure and God bless it.
Yeah, let's enjoy things. And I was like, I don't know the actual like, feelings about it, you know, how it went down soap operatically behind the scenes of the soap opera. But like when you see with this podcast, you see Ben McKenzie take time away from his anti-crypto crusade, which I agree with, by the way, to like, you know, reminisce about what the show meant to him. I mean, people appreciate times in their life, especially when they have some perspective on it.
Absolutely. And that's been really nice. And again, just reconnecting with everybody. And I think everybody feels really good about it. And everybody still is identified with that show, you know, in a really significant way. And I think at first, for some of the actors, that was scary.
Of course.
Because you're like, am I going to ever be able to go on and do other things? But I think, you know, they've all proven that they can and have.
Yeah, they can do Ex Nihilo now, right? Like they can do the next iteration
of
their band.
Exactly.
Did you see how I did that?
Because
that was a reference to City on Fire.
That's why you're you.
Do you guys, so we're going to be posting this today. We're recording it Thursday.
Oh.
I believe episode 5 of City on Fire goes up tomorrow.
Yep. Or tonight, right?
Or late tonight.
Yeah.
And that's 5 of 8 total.
Mm-hmm.
You guys want to, again, no spoilers. Do you want to do like the drive time DJ, like set up what's to come? You want to like, any needle drops you're excited about? Anything that you should think people should get on the train now before it fully leaves the station on its way back to Long Island?
There are
Island?
Trains and stations.
I'm still trying to segue here.
It's great.
No, Liz Garbus directs the next 2 episodes, 5 and 6, and she did an incredible job. 5 is sort of like our 1970s like thriller episode where there's chases and intrigue and it feels really big. There's boats.
God. Wow.
I mean, you're talking about production things in terms
of
like period pieces. You have a whole scene with a helicopter in the background, and I'm just looking at the helicopter being like, these motherfuckers got a helicopter. Like it's good to work for Apple sometimes, I guess.
For sure. Yeah.
And I think for people who've watched the first 4 and are craving, like, I think 4 gets you to that place where you're like, okay, I really want to know like what happened. This next set of episodes really dials that in so that the focus becomes clearer and the characters start to interact with each other and their stories cross in ways that like feel really juicy and fun. There's a big flashback coming up in episode 6 that takes us back to the 80s. What was the 60s in the book?
Oh man, even better.
That really hurt our heads to try to figure out the math of like, so if they're younger in the 2000s, and you're like, oh God, it's actually not that long ago.
I do this.
I mean,
all
somebody
the time.
Just did that, right? If Marty McFly went back in time today, he would go back to 1993.
It's horrific.
Yeah.
And yes, I do this all the time in my head, and it's not great.
Yeah.
Well, I'm excited to see where the show goes from here. City on Fire is on Apple TV Plus. I love every opportunity to talk to you guys, and I'm sure I'll see you on the picket lines, and then hopefully we'll see you on our screens once all this is resolved with whatever comes next. Thanks, Josh and Stephanie.
Thank you.
Thank you.